Last week, I left off talking about employees, employers, being self-employed in the section in this study on money and wealth. In this section, we've been looking at how to acquire money and wealth. And I want to finish up that part of that section and then get on to the other ways of acquiring wealth. And I want to talk about unions here briefly, because unions are go along with employment, employers, and those kind of things. And I don't believe I've ever really preached on unions before, and so I did want to talk a little bit about that. And this is practical preaching. This is things that we have to deal with out there in the workforce, and I want you to have a biblical perspective on it. I'm familiar with unions. I've never been a member of one, but I grew up in a union household, a very pro-union household. My dad was a member of the, it was a state employees union. I think it was one of the largest unions in the country, and he was the president of his local. So we spent our vacations, if you want to call it that. We never really went on vacation, but once a year we would go to these union conventions. And they were in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or Hershey. And we went to these nice swanky hotels and had a nice weekend when I was a kid. And you only know what you know. And so when I, well, of course I was pro-union back then. But the other thing I was going to say is that I thought that that was a normal hotel. And so I didn't have any other experience. So when I started going to like regular people hotels, when I was in high school, like with school trips, and then when I got to be an adult, like the first time I went to, I'm like, man, this place is like small, it's dumpy, there's like no room in here. And my dad kind of laughed, and he's like, yeah, well, the union, the hotels that we go to, the Hilton and these places, those aren't, you know, normal hotels. Like, you didn't have a normal experience there. But I thought that was what all hotels were like back in those days. But anyway, so I have some experience with unions, and I eventually changed my mind when I became an adult and learned some things, started studying economics and learning about how unions aren't what they're all cracked up to be. At least that's what I think. And I think I can prove it with the Bible too, which I intend to do here. One thing you always want to remember, the first thing you want to remember when the topic of unions come up is that what we learned last week, the employer is the master, the employee is the servant. If you remember that simple fact, you will not be pro-union. The employer is the master. The employee is the servant. And I proved that last week from the scripture. So remember that, and you don't need to know anything else. But I'll give you some more information here. So workers do have rights, and we saw that last Sunday. Right? Workers have a right to request higher wages and better working conditions. That's perfectly within their rights. And employers have a right to grant or deny those requests. That's within the employer's right. If a worker doesn't like his wage or his benefits or his working conditions, he can quit. We talked about that last Sunday. We're not in a forced labor situation. We're not in labor camps in Siberia and, you know, it's just unfair that we only get paid what we get paid. If you don't like what you get paid, quit. Go somewhere else. Get another job, right? So, you know, you have the right to ask. You don't have the right to demand. Workers have a right to collectively ask for higher wages or something. You know, if you and five of your buddies think, you know what, I think we should be being paid more, and you make an appointment with the boss and you go into his office and the five of you say, you know, we think that we're not being paid enough and we would like you to consider giving us a pay raise. That's fine. Nothing wrong with you collectively asking for that, and the employer can say yay or nay. He can deny that if he wants to. But workers only have the right to form a union to bargain for better pay or better working conditions if the employer grants them that right. You don't have the right to form an organization within your company on your employer's grounds and demand higher pay from him. That's his private property. That factory, that office space, that's his. You don't have the right to form any organization within your employer's company. And that's what a union is. I mean, you're forming an organization and then electing leaders of your organization, and they're going to go bargain with the employer or whatever. You don't have the right to do that. You don't have the right to form any. I mean, you think you can form a nonprofit charity and in your company and just start running it within the company when the company owner doesn't give you permission to do that? You can't do anything that the company owner doesn't give you permission to do. That is a usurping of authority. Part of the problem is the mindset is that company owners don't own their company, that it's not their private property. You know, the company owner doesn't have the right to do with what he with his own what he wants. And that's with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's part of the problem here. Company owners can't do what they want with their own property. They can't deny certain people to serve certain people if they don't want to. And they should be able to. It's their private property. They should be able to do whatever they want. My kitchen is my own private property. Nobody has the right to bang on my door and say, serve me a meal. No, it's my kitchen. I'll serve you if I want to, right? A company and a company's property owner is no different. So I think that's where one of the reasons why people get mixed up here is that they somehow think that if you start a company, it's public property. It's not public property. It's private property. That company owner can do whatever he wants. I really think people need to understand that. If the employer doesn't want his workers to unionize, he has the right to fire anyone who tries to do so. It's his company. It's his property. And I used to work for a man that did this, or threatened to do this very thing, in Pennsylvania. It was a manufacturing company. Most of the people, it was electronics manufacturing, most of the people that worked there, were workers on the floor. I was in the engineering department, so even if they would have tried to unionize, I wouldn't have been part of that anyway, because typically the people in the offices aren't part of the union anyway. But I had heard, this didn't happen while I was there, but prior to me being there, I had heard stories where there were rumblings out on the floor of starting a union, and word got up to the owner, and he said flat out, you start a union here, I will close this shop down right now. I'll close this whole business down. Multi-million dollar thing, I'll shut it down immediately. You will not unionize in this place. And I don't blame him. It's his company. It's not theirs. You just work there. You don't like it, go somewhere else. It's his company. So unions, unless allowed by the employer, are wrong. Now, if the employer allows a union, if he wants to do that, I don't know why you would, but if he wants to, fine. Maybe it's easier for him to negotiate salaries just with one representative and he can just do it across the board. Be a really dumb idea. Why would you give everybody a raise when half of them are bums? You know, I mean, it makes no sense, right? Some people work really hard, some people don't. Why would you give them all raises? That makes no sense. But anyway, if an employer wants to do that, fine. He can do whatever he wants. But servants have no right to create, as I've said, to create an organization that operates within a company without the owner's approval. And I was just thinking about this last night, and a verse came to mind, and then a couple other ones came to mind. The earth can't bear this kind of thing. You say, well, that's strong language. The earth cannot bear unions. You say, where in the world are you getting that? Proverbs 30, 21 through 22. Proverbs 30, 21 through 22. Here's the principle. For three things the earth is disquieted, and for four which it cannot bear, for a servant when he reigneth, and a fool when he is filled with meat. That's the first thing the earth can't bear, a servant when he reigneth. A servant is not supposed to reign. A servant is not supposed to be in control. A servant doesn't give the orders, he takes them. The earth cannot bear a servant when he reigneth. That's exactly what unions are. Servants reigning. Servants telling the master what he's going to do. And otherwise, if you don't, we'll strike. We will break our contract with you and we will strike. We will stop working when we signed on the dotted line that said we would work. And it's interesting there. It says that the earth is disquieted. If you're familiar with the history of unions, this doesn't happen anymore, I don't think. But boy, back in the day, union strikes got violent. People died. There were shootouts. That's why these company owners had to hire the Pinkertons to come in and, like, restore order. I mean, these people were trying to burn the place down, shooting at scabs, as they call them, anybody that actually wants to work, you know, like wants to do what they said that they would do. And the rest of the bums want to go out here and strike, and the scabs try to break the striking line, and they're beaten and killed. And just go read some of the history of unions. It's crazy. Totally crazy. The earth can't bear it. I can't bear it either. It drives me crazy. It is unseemly. It is unseemly for servants and masters to flip places. Unseemly. Turn with me to Ecclesiastes 10. 5 through 7. I should say it's unseemly to do so in a natural, in an unnatural, revolutionary way. Now, if the master goes out of business for whatever reason, and many of them do, and a servant has a good idea and is entrepreneurial, and the servant ends up eventually employing his old employer, that's fine and dandy. You know, that's fine. If, you know, if the natural course of events happens and people switch places, hey, that's no problem. But when workers overthrow the man who hired them and start dictating what's going to happen in the company, that is wrong. It's called communism, for one thing. That's exactly what the communists wanted. The proletariat to overthrow the bourgeoisie, as they call them, the company owners, the middle class, anyway. Ecclesiastes 10, 5 through 7. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. Now, that's just not right. It is not right for servants to be on horses when princes are walking. It's not right for the people who are supposed to be serving to be the ones who are elevated and are at a high rank, and the ones that are supposed to be served are the ones that are doing the serving. It's not the way it's supposed to work. The rich are not supposed to sit in low place. If you're a rich company owner, it's because you got there more than likely by working very, very, very hard and building a company, and you deserve what you have. And you shouldn't be sitting in low place while some union boss sits there and demands what you're going to pay people and what you're going to do. That's why, in my opinion, you got to nip these things in the bud. That's why you got to do what my old company owner, Rick Turner, did. You tell him, you even try it, I'll close this company down. I will fire every one of you. Because you let the camel's nose under the tent, and before you know it, you're being dictated what to do. And then you're going to be paying every lazy bum $50 an hour to do menial work, unskilled labor. It's like that. Did you hear about that strike they had here? Oh, it was only maybe within a year ago, the dock workers strike. You remember that on the East Coast? Might have been the West Coast too, but in the East Coast, I remember. Dock workers, they were going to strike, and they weren't getting paid enough. And I just assumed, oh, they must be getting paid, you know, just a pittance or something. They're upset about this. You know, stupid me. Starting salary was like $85,000 a year for the lowest man on the totem pole starting off. And most of these guys were making over six figures, loading and unloading Connex boxes, basically. And the big wigs were making, you know, over $200,000, and they wanted to strike. And in their demands, they demanded that the employer could not automate anything. So no automation whatsoever. No machines that would save any labor, nothing like that. That's what they demanded. They wanted more money, and they wanted no competition. Why do you think American automakers haven't been able to compete very well with foreign automakers? One of the big reasons is the UAW, the Auto Workers Union. Right, they drive wages up to nosebleed levels, way higher than the market would ever have them to be, and then the companies can't be profitable. How in the world are you supposed to be profitable paying far more than the labor that you're paying is able to produce? Servants have no right to demand concessions from their master. An employer has the right to do whatever he wants with his own company and pay his workers whatever he has agreed to pay them. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 20. Remember that this is the principle. You remember this principle and you'll know all you need to know about unions. You think, well, without unions, we'd all just get paid a dime an hour and we'd all be in poverty. Was there a union in Henry Ford's plant, in his auto plant? No, there wasn't. No, not for a long time anyway. Back when he was paying workers $5 a day. You think $5 a day, that's nothing. Do the math. $5 a day was a lot of money. That's $25 a week. In the day when an ounce of gold cost $20. He was paying them more than an ounce of gold a week. You know what an ounce of gold is worth now? Almost $3,000. $3,000 per week. What's that? $150-some thousand per year in, you know, that's the equivalent back in those days. He was paying his assembly line workers over $150,000 per year in today's dollars to work on an assembly line. Without a union. The market will work these things out. Anyway, Matthew 20 and verse 15. This is the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. We looked at this last week or the week before. In verse 15, here's the punchline of the whole thing. You remember the story. He goes out, he hires somebody, he says, I'll pay you a penny a day. You work the whole day for me. He goes back out at noon. Find some more guys, say, I'll pay you what's fair. He goes back out in the afternoon, I'll pay you what's fair. He goes to the 11th hour, come work for me, I'll pay you what's fair. And he pays them all a penny, right? And then some, the ones that bore the heat of the day, that worked the whole day for what they agreed to work for, they're upset now because everybody else got paid what they got paid. And here's what the company owner says. These are the words of our Lord Jesus Christ. So if you got a problem with this, you got a problem with him, not me. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good? Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? It's a rhetorical question. The answer is yes. It is lawful for you to do whatever you want with your own property. I mean, assuming, obviously, that you're not breaking the law of God, you're not killing people and stealing from them and whatever else. But the point is, he can contract to pay somebody whatever they agree to work for, and he can do with whatever, he can do that however he wants. If he wants to pay one guy a whole day's wage for working an hour, he can do that. Right? If he agreed to pay you a day's wage for working for a day, and then he decides to be generous and give another man the whole day's wage for working an hour, he can do it. It's his company, it's his money. It's his business. He doesn't have to pay everybody the same amount or the same amount, you know, for the work that they did. It's the same hourly rate. I'll put it that way. He doesn't have to pay everybody the same hourly rate. He can pay whatever he wants as long as it's contractually agreed upon. I missed a verse. Proverbs 19 and verse 10. There's one more back there where I talk about servants don't have the right to organize. Proverbs 19 and verse 10. Delight is not seemly for a fool, much less for a servant to have rule over princes. You see the principle. Servants don't rule over princes. Employees don't rule over employers. People got everything all backwards these days. Unions are unnecessary. Like my example with Henry Ford. And the free market will raise wages to a fair rate when employers and employees can freely negotiate wages. They will be at a market fair rate. Because the market will fix an employer who doesn't want to pay enough. If he doesn't want to pay enough, then somebody else will offer more, and the employees go to the person that's offering more. And that makes the other man have to raise wages in order to attract employees. If he doesn't do so, he doesn't get the good employees. And even if he does manage to hire somebody, he's not going to hire the best people, and he's going to be at a strategic disadvantage, and he's going to go out of business. So the market will raise wages to a fair level, whatever that is. People don't understand, I don't think, the nature of the free market and what the free market does. The free market is what has created the wealth and the real wages and the raised wages that we see, not unions. People think that prior to unions, everybody was making 10 cents an hour, and unions came along, and now we have a five-day work week, 40 hours a week, and everybody makes a good wage. But if it wasn't for the unions, everybody would just be making nothing. The employers would just be paying next to nothing, and that's just simply not true. It's like anything else. It's like so many things. People, the government steps in and tries to fix a trend that is already going in the right direction, whether it's up or down, depending on what the thing is, whether it's good or bad to go up or down. So like wages are already increasing, right? Because the late 1800s was probably one of the most productive periods in our history. And the standard of living was increasing greatly. Now, granted, it was increasing from a very, very low level, but it was increasing greatly. And then unions come around, probably early 1900s, I guess, after this trend has already been in play for a long time. And then wages continue to increase after unions come along and they say, see, look at what the union did there. If it wasn't for the union, you'd be back when it was like in the 1700s. They forget to tell you that the wages were already increasing because of capitalism, because of equipment, labor-saving equipment that could make people more productive than they would have otherwise been. And that's all also why the amount of hours people work can decrease. Because when you can produce more and more through machines, then you don't need to work nearly as many hours because you can produce a lot of stuff in a smaller amount of time. So naturally, then the work hours come down too. It's not the unions. It's the free market. It's like the war on poverty. Poverty had been going down for a long time, basically since the Industrial Revolution. And then along comes LBJ in the 1960s and says, we need to declare war on poverty. We need to get rid of poverty. And the government throws millions and billions of dollars trying to get rid of and eradicate poverty. And you look at the poverty line, and it just goes steadily down. And when the war on poverty starts, you don't really even notice anything. It just keeps going steadily down. Right, the war on poverty didn't do anything. It didn't cause any poverty to end. As a matter of fact, the rate of poverty would have gone down at an accelerated pace if it wasn't for the war on poverty, I do believe. Because when the government throws money at anything, all they do is make it worse. The free market was able to overrule what the government was trying to do. If you think about it, if unions bring prosperity, then why don't we go over to Bangladesh, to these poor people, one of the poorest countries in the world, why don't we just force all their companies there to unionize and then force them to pay $50 an hour? And all these people in Bangladesh will be wealthy like we are. They just need unions, that's all. What's going to happen if you unionize all the shops in Bangladesh and force them to pay $50 an hour? There's not going to be any shops in Bangladesh. And the people are going to be a lot poorer than they are right now. Unions do not raise, well, they do artificially raise wages, but ultimately unions do not bring about prosperity. They destroy prosperity. It's just that the free market is so good at creating prosperity, it can create prosperity in spite of unions. It's amazing these companies can still stay in business with unions in them, but they do because that's how powerful the market is. It's like the same thing with minimum wage. I mentioned minimum wage here a few weeks ago, and I didn't mention one thing that I wanted to mention now. If the minimum wage is so good, and if all we need to do to get everybody to have a living wage is just raise the minimum wage, then why don't we raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour? Let's just raise it to $100 an hour. Every one of us is going to be making a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. We're all going to have all kinds of money. It's going to be great. We can all live in nice houses. We can all buy nice cars. Everything's going to be great. We'll all make $200,000 a year. Why not? I mean, why not raise it to 100 bucks an hour? You know what that's going to do? It's going to unemploy anybody who cannot produce $100 an hour worth of production. That's what it's going to do. So with the exception of heart surgeons, you know, and really good lawyers, and, you know, very, very few people, the rest of the country is going to be unemployed because the rest of us can't produce $100 an hour. We don't have the skills or know-how or whatever. So if a $100 minimum wage creates massive unemployment, what does a $15 wage, minimum wage, what does that create? Unemployment, just less unemployment, but it creates unemployment. Any minimum wage that is above the market rate creates unemployment. $100 minimum wage would unemploy pretty much all of us. A $15 minimum wage will unemploy kids, people that have no skills, right? People that are you know, very low on the employment ladder. Fast food workers and things like that. Not only are unions unnecessary, though, unions are harmful. Because unions oftentimes seek to increase wages above the market rate, which will cause companies to become unprofitable and go out of business. Why do you think GM went bankrupt years ago? A big part of it was the wages that they had to pay. These sky-high wages. And these huge, the pension. You know, their pension was another big problem, which I guess companies started those pensions in an effort to attract workers or something, but it's a very, very bad, pensions are a very bad idea, especially in a time when life expectancy continues to increase. Now it's decreasing, so maybe pensions wouldn't be such a bad idea, but when life expectancy was increasing and people were living longer and longer, you know, and then retiring earlier and earlier, and you're paying people to sit on their butts and do nothing for 20 years or something. You know, try to run a business like that when you're paying who knows how many former employees to sit on their butts and do nothing for years and decades of their life. Amazing, any of them stayed in business at all. But unions also disincentivize hard work and diligence because all workers get wage increases, get raises, regardless of performance. That's how they work. Everybody gets a raise. And it's like union mindset has crept its way into public education too. Everybody gets a diploma. I mean, does anybody actually fail high school anymore? I mean, I don't know. If you show up, does anybody not get a diploma? I've never heard of anybody like not getting one if you actually showed up and did anything at all. Everybody gets a diploma. Everybody gets a prize. Everybody's a winner, right? Everybody, right? This is that kind of mindset. We're all in this together. If I ever hear that term one more time, I'm going to commit an atrocity. We're in this together. I hate that term from the pandemic years. We're in this together. Whoa. Unions also protect lazy people from being fired. You can fire somebody who's unionized, but I mean, he's pretty much got to murder the CEO's wife or something. I mean, it's protect the lazy. Then they do stupid things like only the person, whatever your job description is, you can only do that particular thing and you can't do anything else. You can screw in light bulbs, you know, but you can't install the light switch or something. And so you screw in the light bulbs, but the guy that installs the light switch, no, he's got to come and do that. And if he's not here, then it can't be done. I mean, that kind of nonsense. Terrible. Anyway, so now we've gotten past the employment, employee, self-employment, employer, you know, all that stuff. We want to look at some other ways of generating income. And these would be inferior ways. Because as I said, you know, the majority of us, and this is the way it should be, all the wealth that you acquire is going to be through working. Now, you can acquire other wealth through investing, and we'll talk about that later, but the initial wealth that you acquire is going to be through working. But there are some other ways. There is receiving an inheritance, and I want to talk about that. I want to basically talk mainly about the negative things about inheritance now. And then towards the end of this series here in a few years from now, I want to talk about how we should save and give an inheritance. We're commanded to do so. But I want to talk about the negative effects of inheritance right now. Inheritance is a way to acquire money, but it's an inferior way to build wealth. And the reason is because that something it has not worked for is usually not appreciated and not managed well. And that's just a fact of human nature. If you didn't work for it, you don't appreciate it. I don't know the statistics, but I imagine if you did a study and you looked at college students, the college students whose parents or somebody paid and gave them a free ride to college versus the college students that paid their own way, I would be willing to bet huge sums of money that the graduation rates and the GPAs are going to be far higher for the students who pay their own way than for the students whose parents paid for the whole thing and gave it to them. I would bet money on that, because when something is handed to you, you just don't appreciate it and you don't manage it as well. I mean, take a child, give him some kind of a toy, whether it's a big expensive toy or a small toy or whatever. See how he treats that toy, and then make him save up money for months or years to buy that same thing and see how he treats it. I guarantee he's going to treat it very differently. That's just how it works. Here's a quote from The Millionaire Next Door, this book that I've told you about a few times. I'm going to be quoting from it quite a bit here in this study. It was written by Thomas Stanley and another guy. I didn't write his name down. But anyway, these two researchers, and these guys did a ton of work for this book. This book was the result of, I think, decades, many, many years at least, I don't remember, but many, many years of a lot of research. And they interviewed thousands and thousands of millionaires and wealthy people, and they learned a ton of things, many of which they would not have expected when they embarked on this journey. But here's what they had to say about parents who give financial gifts to their children. Now, this is not an inheritance upon death, necessarily. This is what a lot of wealthy parents do, is that they give gifts to their children, their adult children, while they're still alive. And they think they're helping them, and the research shows that they're, in many cases, they are not actually helping them. As a matter of fact, they're hurting them. Here's what they say. Note that in 8 of the 10 occupational categories, he's talking about the 10 occupational categories that the children of wealthy people tend to go into. Okay, so he gave those categories. And he says in 8 out of 10 of them, okay, gift receivers, that's the adult children, have smaller levels of net worth, that is wealth, than those who did not receive gifts. Okay, the gift receivers have smaller levels of net worth than those who did not receive the gifts. Now, again, you'd think this seems like it's backwards. You have two children, maybe they're from the same family, maybe they're not from the same family, but anyway, you got two children, they both make the same amount of money, and one of them, the parents give $10,000 per year in gifts. And the other one, their parents give them nothing in gifts. And despite these children making, these adult children making the same amount of money, the ones who don't receive the 10 grand a year have more net worth than the ones who do receive the 10 grand a year. And you say, how is that possible? Because all it does is spur consumption. The ones that get the gifts just spend more, they don't live within their means, and they expect more gifts, and they get used to a consumptive lifestyle. Later on in the book, they go on to say, many of the most highly productive sons and daughters receive no wealth transfers whatsoever. No inheritance, no gifts, no nothing. Yet, as we have discussed in chapter 5, that's one reason they're wealthy. Why are they wealthy? Because they didn't get money from their parents. That's why they're wealthy. There are a lot of things that are that seem to be counterintuitive regarding money. I talked about in the first installment of this series how people that look like they're wealthy aren't. You know, most people, you look at people driving the nice new cars, especially new luxury fancy cars, you think, oh, those people got money. No, they don't. They don't have any money. They got a big car with a bunch of debt. That's all. They don't have any money. And children who receive gifts, you think that they would be the ones that are wealthy. You think, well, you get them off to a good start. You know, you give them a gift, maybe you give them a down payment on a house, or maybe even buy them a house, and they're going to be off to a good start in life. And now they're going to be able to build wealth. Nope. The data shows that you just set them, you just embark them in a life of consumption, and they're not going to build wealth. Strange as it seems. I got more quotes for you on that in a minute. Inheritances often turn out to not be the blessings that they first appear to be. Let's look at Proverbs 20 and verse 21. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. Inheritances are good with wisdom. If you got wisdom, an inheritance is a good thing. If you don't have wisdom, an inheritance is at best just not helpful. And at worst, it's actually going to make things worse. But I'll talk about that later too. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. An inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. Now we know the nature of the Proverbs, right? They are pithy sayings that are generally found to be true. In general, when you get an inheritance hastily, your parents die and they leave you a big sum of money, seems like a great day, doesn't it? But the end thereof shall not be blessed. In general, the person that receives especially a large inheritance, the end's not going to be blessed. I have an example, if I get to it today, about lottery winnings. And I'm going to tell you a story about a man that was probably one of the worst, most ignominious cases of a lottery winner you can imagine. This is unbelievable. If we get there, you'll see what I'm talking about. But an inheritance gotten in youth will be squandered by most people. Let's look at Luke 15, 12 through 14. That's why I read this passage here, this story of the prodigal son. Because like I said, it's not it doesn't say it's a parable. It doesn't use parabolic language. It's most likely a story of a prodigal son that received an inheritance, went off and lived like an idiot, blew it all, and came crawling back on his hands and knees to daddy to go be a servant in his dad's house. It's happened many, many times over the years. So it's not a parable. And generally speaking, give a kid, the younger the worse, you know, the younger they are, the worse. Give a teenager, late teenager, somebody just graduated high school, give them a huge inheritance. You want to destroy their life? Let me tell you what. You want your son to die of a drug overdose and be a complete mess, give him a big inheritance at 18 years old. I mean, you may as well give him a loaded pistol and have him play Russian roulette or something. That's about the odds. If you're going to leave a big inheritance to your children, make sure it's when they're a lot older and they've proven themselves to be wise. But I'll talk about that later as well. Luke 15, 12 through 14. And the younger, let's just start with verse 11. And he said, a certain man had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me. And he divided unto them his living. Now, number one, I don't know what this father's thinking. Let me tell you what. If I'm a father and I've got two sons and my one son comes and says, hey, give me the portion that falls to me. I'd be like, go pound sand, buddy. You don't tell me to give you anything. Are you kidding me? I mean, I'll give you an inheritance if I want to, when I want to. Tell me to give you your inheritance. You're out of your mind. But anyway, he did it for whatever reason. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land and he began to be in want. That's what happens when you give a fool, especially a young fool, a big inheritance. He goes and blows it. I know a kid back home. He was involved in a car accident when he was a little boy, only a couple of years old. And I forget the had something to do with the amount. His father was wealthy, grandfather was wealthy, who was had custody of him. And he it was something about the amount of car insurance policies that he had. And I don't remember. Anyway, this kid ended up getting an astronomical amount of money because of this accident. And it was, of course, given to the grandparents. And then they set it up in some kind of a trust where I think he'll get, I don't know if he gets the money, all the money at 28 years old or something. And I think only then he gets it in monthly installments. But he's going to be making like six figures a year for the rest of his life, starting in his late 20s, which is a disaster waiting to happen, I'm sure. But anyway, this kind of, like I said, I don't know where I was going. Somehow I got sidetracked on that. But anyway, not a good thing to get a big amount of money like that in youth. It's sadly, though, it's not just younger people. Many older people quickly spend the inheritance that they're given as well. I've witnessed this. I've seen people, I mean, like, I'm talking like adult people, like in near the end of life, getting a nice chunk of inheritance is gone. I mean, gone like almost immediately. In some cases, gone before they even get it. They find out what they're getting, and they go out and spend all the money before they even get it. They buy the whatever, the tractor, and add on to the house or whatever, before the money even comes in. And then for the next year, they're like, hey, when am I getting my money? When am I getting my money? I got these loans I got to pay on the money I just blew for my inheritance. I've seen it happen. I know what I'm talking about. It's insane. And how frustrating to be the old person that scrimped and saved and was wise with your money and then leaves it and then, you know, the kids blow it in a heartbeat. Just terribly sad. But anyway. Leaving an inheritance or giving financial gifts to children will often make them worse off in the long run. Now, these are not just the rantings of some crazy preacher. Here is what they had to say in The Millionaire Next Door. This is, like I said, based on a lot of research. It said, for example, affluent parents often subsidize their children's purchase of a home. The intent may be to help their children, quote, get started on the right foot, unquote. The parents assume that such gifts are a once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon. Some have told us that they thought, quote, this would be the last dollar the kids would ever need, unquote. They assume that the recipients of their kindness will be able to, quote, do it on their own, unquote, in the near future. Nearly half the time, they are wrong. This is what they found out. Nearly half the time, help your kids out, give them a down payment on the house, right? Give them gifts like that, help them to purchase their first home, and now I've got them over the hump. Now they've got the down payment, they've got the house, or maybe you paid for the whole thing for them, and now they don't have a mortgage, and they'll be able to really start, you know, laying aside a bunch of their money and investing, and they'll be well off for the rest of their lives. Half the time, they're wrong. It doesn't work that way. Gift receivers frequently are underachievers in generating income. All too often, the income of the gift receiver does not increase at the same rate as his consumption. Remember, expensive homes are typically located in what we call high consumption neighborhoods. Living in such neighborhoods requires more than just being able to pay the mortgage. To fit in, one needs to, quote, look the part, unquote, in terms of one's clothing, landscaping, home maintenance, automobiles, furnishings, and so on. And don't forget to add high property taxes to all the other items. The quote goes on, but let me just say this. Say you think you have young children, they just get married, they're just starting on their own, and they really want to have their own home, but home prices are very expensive, and you think, I'll just give them the down payment for the house. And then they'll be able to get into a house, and then they'll be now they can be, you know, building equity in their house and all this, and it'll be better for them. You know, they won't be renting and throwing their money away, which is what everybody thinks. Anybody that says that has never used a calculator before, and I'd be glad to share the figures with you if you'd like. If you're renting a cheap apartment, if you're renting a 3-bedroom house, yeah, forget about it. You're throwing your money away. But if you're renting a cheap apartment, you're not throwing your money away. But anyway, So you give them a down payment for the house. But what happens when you do that? If you wouldn't have done that, they would, if they're smart, they would have continued to save and to scrimp, and they would have maybe bought a $200,000 house, which today, you know, back in the day, that was a really nice house. Today, that's like a dump in a bad part of town, basically. But they would have bought the not so nice house, the $200,000 house that they could actually afford. Because I'll talk about this later, but here's how you know if you can afford a house or not. You got a 20% down payment. Your mortgage payment is less than 25% of your take-home pay on a 15-year mortgage. That's if you can afford the house. If your mortgage payment is more than 25% of your take-home pay on a 15-year, you can't afford the house. If you got a 30-year, and you have a 30-year because, you know, you can't afford the 25% take-home pay payment on a 15, you can't afford the house, right? Well, what happens is, so these kids that would have bought the $200,000 dump and then paid it off and maybe eventually were able to, you know, to upsize to something nicer, what are they going to do now? They're going to buy a $375,000 or whatever, maybe a $300,000. They're going to buy a $300,000 decent place, except they can't afford it, right? The payments are too high. They're too much of their take-home pay. They're going to be debt slaves for 30 years, right? So what have you done? Have you helped them? No. Really, you haven't helped them. You've just got them into a cycle of debt and poverty. They're going to be what is called house poor now. Their house is going to be too much of their monthly income. Seems like a nice thing to do until you really think about it. And in many cases, it's not a nice thing to do. I continue with the quote. Thus, a gift of a down payment, whether full or partial, can place a recipient on a treadmill of consumption and continued dependence on the gift giver. But the majority of these recipients' neighbors, more likely than not, receive no cash gifts from their parents. They are much more content and confident about their lifestyle than most gift receivers are. Many gift receivers in such situations become sensitive to the need for continued economic outpatient care. Economic outpatient care is the phrase that these authors use to refer to wealthy people giving their adult children money, you know, to help their adult children out. Economic outpatient care. Their orientation may even dramatically change from a focus on self-generated economic achievement to one of hoping for and contemplating the arrival of additional gifts. Underachieving income producers in such cases find it nearly impossible to accumulate wealth. So in this case, he's talking about wealthy people. So maybe wealthy people, they help their children to get a house in a nice neighborhood, right? They give them a down payment. They get his house in this nice neighborhood. And maybe they give them some money every month. You know, they're giving them some, you know, $1,000 a month or something to help them out with a mortgage payment. But guess what? Now they're living among people that actually are making their own way, maybe, you know, and they got to live like those people, and they got to drive a car like those people. They got to dress like those people. They got to throw parties like those people. They got to send their kids to private schools like those people. And before you know it, all of a sudden they can't keep up with this lifestyle. They're living in a place and they're living among people that are out of their league. It doesn't work. And then they just want more and more. And then they expect their parents to pay for the kids' private schooling and this, that, and the other thing. They talked about that in this book. Now, they go on to say later on in the book, the more dollars adult children receive, the fewer dollars they accumulate, while those who are given fewer dollars accumulate more. You want your kids to be wealthy? Give them nothing. You want them to be wealthy? Give them nothing. You want them to be poor, just from early adulthood on, just keep subsidizing them, keep helping them out, keep giving them money, give them money here, give them money there, help them with this, help them with that. Keep them poor, keep them dependent on you. This is a statistically proven relationship. Yet many parents still think that their wealth can automatically transform their children into economically productive adults. They are wrong. Discipline and initiative can't be purchased like automobiles or clothing off a rack. in a way, I feel bad for the children of wealthy people, because you grow up with a certain standard, and chances are you may not be able to make that standard yourself without your parents continually helping you out your whole life, and you become a dependent. I just feel bad for them. And there's got to be a lot of pressure there to live up to your parents' level of wealth, and you may not be able to do that. And then as parents, what are you going to do? Are you going to let Johnny just be an average Joe Blow slob living in a normal house? Or are you going to keep giving Johnny money his whole life so that Johnny can look like he's doing well, so that you look like you're doing well because your children are? They go on to say, is a rent-free environment ideal for a young entrepreneur? Because some parents think, well, you know, wealthy parents, I want my child to be a business owner. I want him to start a business, so I'll let him live here rent-free, and that way he can get on his feet and get his business going, and, you know, and I can help him out that way. And they give an example in the book of parents that did this. And this poor lady started some kind of a business living at home, and the business never really was profitable, but just went on for years and years and years with her parents just helping out. And it's just all a big fake. It's just a facade. It looks like she's got a business, and she really doesn't. Is a rent-free environment ideal for a young entrepreneur? We don't think so. Nor is the gift of a business. The most successful business owners are the ones who put much of their own resources behind their ventures. Many succeed because they have to succeed. It's their money, their product, their reputation. They have no safety net. They have no one else to rely upon for their success or failure. I think that's very true. If you're going to make it, typically the ones that make it are the ones that put in the blood, sweat, and tears, that do it themselves. They don't have somebody else backstopping them. So here's my word of advice. If you want to make your broke, big spending, financially irresponsible, or lazy children better off, give them nothing. Now, I'm not talking about your wise, diligent, frugal children. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about your broke, big spending, financially irresponsible, or lazy children. You want to make them better off? Give them nothing. Give them nothing. And then maybe reality will hit them in the forehead like a 2x4, and they'll get their acts together, maybe. But sadly, that is the opposite of what most parents do. I quote again from The Millionaire Next Door. Often, the unemployed have a history of being in and out of work. Others are so-called professional students. I've known some of these. Typically, their parents view these children as needing the money more than their brothers and sisters do now and in the future. Thus, the unemployed are more than twice as likely as their working brothers and sisters to receive inheritances. This is so perverse, but this is what happens. I'm telling you, it happens all the time. Parents, I feel bad for little Johnny. I mean, the guy, he doesn't have a job. You know, he got fired again. And I just, you know, his boss expected him to show up on time and work 40 hours a week. I mean, totally ridiculous. Poor Johnny. So I can't leave my inheritance to my wealthy kid that actually worked hard and was frugal and diligent. I got to leave it to this bum because he, quote, needs it. This is what people do. I've seen this happen. I knew two brothers. The one brother was well off, income-wise, anyway, had a good income. And the other brother was either unemployed or barely employed. And these are not kids. I mean, these are like middle-aged adult men, okay? And the parents had determined to leave the unemployed or the barely employed bum, basically. They were going to leave him the house, or I think maybe houses, I can't remember, because he needs it. And you know, the one that had the decent income, the good income and all that, he was doing well and didn't need it. So, you know, the bum was going to get left everything. I'm sorry, that's not the way I operate. I am virtually certain, if I was a parent in that situation, the bum would not be receiving the lion's share of the inheritance, if any, but definitely not being not receiving much anyway. I can tell you that much. You say you'd leave it to the kid that's well off? Yeah. And I got Bible for you later on today if I get there. Wise men often have a sad reality to face. They spend a lifetime saving and being prudent with their money only to leave it to children or to others who will waste it. Ecclesiastes 9, 18 through 21. I say 9, I'm at 2. Ecclesiastes 2, 18 through 21. It's a sad reality. But it happens frequently. Ecclesiastes 2:18. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun. This is Solomon, like one of the richest men in the world's ever known. Because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor, wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. I built up this great big estate, and I'm going to leave it to some kid, and how do I know if he's going to be a wise man or a fool? Vanity, what a waste of time. Therefore, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took, had took is improper, we were just talking about that this morning, which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom, and in knowledge and in equity, yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. Here's Solomon that labored in wisdom and in knowledge, and he'd gotten much estate. He's going to leave it to some dolt who hasn't spent 5 minutes doing what Solomon did and is just going to probably blow it all. Very sad. Psalm 39 and verse 6. Psalm 39 and verse 6. Surely every man walketh in a vain show. That's a good description of American culture right there. Walking in a vain show, everybody looks like they're doing great and they're all broke. Surely they are disquieted in vain. He heapeth up riches and knoweth not who shall gather them. And that's what happens a lot of times. So deciding who to leave his wealth to is a very difficult decision for a wise man. Now some people just leave it, just split it up evenly with their kids and just leave it at that. And I mean, that's easy. That's the easy way to do it. I mean, I'm not saying you're not necessarily wrong for doing that. You don't have a difficult decision at all if that's what you want to do. And maybe you'll keep the peace among your children better if you just disperse it all evenly. There, you can cause a lot of family strife by not leaving it evenly. So I'm not saying it's wrong to do that. But I think, you know, for somebody who really worked hard and spent a lot of their life building up what they have and want to make sure it goes to somebody who's going to use it well, it's a big decision to make, very difficult decision of who to leave it to. I personally would want to leave my wealth to someone, and I've said this before, who both needs it and will be wise with it. That would be the ideal candidate for me if I had wealth, to leave it to somebody who needs it and will be wise with it. But the problem with that is that those two things are usually mutually exclusive, because those who need money usually are not wise with it. That's why they need it, because they weren't wise with what they had. And those who are wise with it usually don't need more. So people that need it wouldn't probably be wise with it. And those who don't need it and are wise with it, well, they don't need it. Now, some wise men are inclined to leave their wealth to those who are already well off, having demonstrated an ability to manage money well. And therefore, you know, they know that their hard-earned money is not going to be wasted. I'll give you an example of this. This is in the Bible, Matthew 25, 28 through 29. You remember the parable of the talents. And he gave one 5 talents, he gave another 2 talents, he gave another 1 talent. The guy that got the 5 talents, he made 5 more and he had 10. The guy that got the 2 made 2 more and had 4. And the guy that had the 1 talent, what did he do with it? Hid it in the earth, didn't do anything with it because he was lazy. And so then when the master comes back, when the owner comes back to reckon with him, he finds out what they've done. Oh, this guy, he had 5, he made 5 more, he had 2, he made 2 more. And then this bum didn't do anything with it. And he says, take his talent and give it to him that's got the 10 talents. Matthew 25:28-29. Take therefore the talent from him and give it unto him that hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. Now, some people are going to think, well, that's not right. You mean to tell me that you'd have, maybe you have 3 children, and 2 of them do really well? Maybe one is exceptionally talented, and he ends up with a lot of wealth, and a lot of, you know, his life is going very well. And one of them is moderately talented, and he does well with what he has, and he turns out pretty well, too. And then you got one who's just a bum? And you mean you're not going to give the bum anything? You're going to give it to the rich kid? That's what God says. That's what God says. I think this would be a wise approach. But it'll be one that will make most people angry with you and question your character. Your kids will definitely, the bum, your lazy kid's definitely going to be mad at you. Maybe your other kids would even be mad at you. I don't know. And anybody that finds out what you did will be mad at you too. You say, how do you know that? Because I got Bible. Luke 19 24-26. This is a similar parable of the pounds. In this case, he gave everybody 1 pound. And the one was very diligent and made 10. The other was diligent and made 5. The other one didn't do anything with it. Didn't make anything with it. And what's he do? He takes the pound away from the one that did nothing with it and he gives it to the guy that has 10 pounds. And people think that the man here is wrong. They question him. They think that this is just not right. Look at what it says here. Luke 19, 24-26. And he said unto them that stood by, take from him the pound and give to him that hath 10 pounds. And they say unto him, Lord, he hath 10 pounds. What are you thinking? He's already got 10 pounds. Why would you take it and get what you at least give it to the guy with 5? As a matter of fact, you should probably take 5 of the pounds of the guy that has 10 and give it to the bum that doesn't have, only has 1. That's what most people think. I mean, make it fair. And the Lord says, no, I'm going to take from the lazy guy and I'm going to give it to the rich guy. So if you do that, if you don't leave an equal inheritance and you leave it to, you know, your wise children that are actually going to use it well and not blow it all, just expect people to be angry with you, that's all. Except you're going to be dead, so it ain't going to matter anyway, right? I mean, if it's an inheritance after you're dead. Now here's a bit of advice that I have, take it or leave it. If a wealthy person has adult children or grandchildren that he's considering leaving an inheritance to, here's what I would consider doing. I think this would be a good idea. Give $10,000 to each child or grandchild and tell them that it is theirs to do with whatever they want and give them only one request. Okay, this is no strings attached. Here is $10,000. Do with it whatever you want. This is yours. You can do anything you want with it. But I have one request. Come back to me in a year and tell me what you spent the money on. What did you do with the money? That's the only thing I request. Here's 10 grand. Totally no strings attached. Just let me know what you did with it in a year. That's it. Now, you know, if you're not that wealthy, maybe $1,000 or whatever, you know. Those who spent all or most of it on consumer goods, like vehicles or toys, I mean like big boy toys, like four-wheelers or side-by-sides or motorcycles or whatever, or furniture, unnecessary home improvements, or, you know, that kind of stuff, or that spent it on leisure and entertainment, like vacations and going out to eat, going to shows, going out for drinks, you know, that kind of stuff, having fun, whatever. Those who spent all or most of it on those kind of things, I say they should receive no inheritance or very little because they've proven that they'll waste it. You want to know what somebody will do with $100,000? Give them $1,000. Give them $1,000, you'll know what they'll do with $100,000. Give them $10,000, you'll know what they'll do with $1,000,000. They blow the $1,000, they'll blow the $100,000. They blow the $10,000, they'll blow $1,000,000. I got Bible for you. Luke 16, the second half of verse 10 to verse 12. Luke 16, second half of verse 10. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. Like I said, give him the $1,000. Is he unjust in that? Is he stupid with that? He's going to be stupid with much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? Now those of the children or grandchildren who save or invest all or most of it, they're worthy to receive an inheritance because they've shown themselves to be wise, prudent, and responsible with money. Or I would say also pay off debt. You give it to them, they pay off debt with it. You know, they take that 10 grand and, you know, pay off that stupid car loan that they have or put it on their mortgage or whatever. That'd be all right. So if they invest it or save it or pay off debt, then you know, okay, might be all right. Luke 16 and verse 10, the first part. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. You gave him $1,000, you gave him $10,000, whatever. And he invested it and saved it. Maybe spent a little bit, you know, went out and had a little dinner, whatever, and did some nice thing or whatever, you know, maybe spent a little bit. But the vast majority of it, saved it, invested it, was wise with it. He'd be a candidate in my book for a larger inheritance. But the ones that blew it, look, I didn't work my entire life and build up the wealth that I have to give it to somebody who's going to waste it. I'm sorry. No thanks. I may as well just write out a big fat check extra on my taxes to the government. I know they'll blow it too, right? I may as well just give it to the IRS rather than give it to some stupid kids who's just going to waste it. It takes wisdom for an inheritance to be a blessing instead of a waste. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 11. I mentioned this verse earlier. And I've said this before and I'll say it again. If you're going to leave an inheritance to your children, you better spend your life teaching them wisdom of how to deal with money, how to be wise with money. Because leaving an inheritance to a kid who has not been taught by precept and example how to manage money, that is going to be a waste of your money at the least, and it's going to be harming that child at worst. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. But foolishness is not good with an inheritance. I like what Dave Ramsey did. I probably will talk about this later. But from the time his kids were wee little, he taught them. Anytime they had to work. They always had to work from like the youngest of ages. Never gave them an allowance or anything like that. And then taught them, you know, when they got money, they had, I think it was three containers. Give, save, spend. Taught them to give to the Lord. Give, be generous towards others. And then save a bunch of it. And then they had they're spending money from the time they're wee little. And then when they got to be not very old, I mean, young teenagers, got them their own bank accounts, not a credit card, but got them their own bank accounts. And then they would work. They managed their own money. And then he would, I thought this is a really good idea. I hadn't even thought about this. For their school clothes, their uniforms for sports, anything that they had to do, like things that, at school that cost money, the parents would pay for that stuff, like food or clothing, you know, basic needs. But what they would do is they would take the money and put it into the kid's bank account. Here's your money for school clothes this year. You know, here's your X amount of dollars for school clothes. You buy the clothes. And if you blow the money and you're walking around in ripped up rags, I don't care. You're going to be, you can be naked for all I care. If you blow the money, that's on you. They gave them their own money to pay for those necessary things, which I thought was great. Teach them how to manage their own money. But for anything outside of clothing and things that the parents provide, everything else those kids wanted, they had to save for. When they bought a car, the kids had to save for it. They let them know from young age, we're not buying you a car. Now, Ramsey did something, and I'll talk about this later. He offered to match half of what his kids would save for a car. I don't know that I would do that. But he offered to match half of that, and one of his daughters was very wise and frugal and good with money, and she about ended up making him go broke because she saved up so darn much money that the half of that was a lot of money. And so I think after that he said, you know, half, and there's a cap, you know, only a certain amount. But I don't know if I'd do the half thing. I'd probably just make them pay for it themselves. But anyway, I thought that was great, you know. And they said, Dad, you know how hard it is to be Dave Ramsey's kid? I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, like no other kids have to live like this. He said, you're going to inherit my fortune someday, and I want you to be able to manage it well. That was a long time ago. He wasn't worth nearly as much then. He's worth $750 million now. And he can leave $750 million to those kids, and they will probably manage it very well because he taught them from a young age how to manage money. Now, wisdom's good with an inheritance, but the prosperity of fools will destroy them. And I'm not going to get to the rest of the study, so this is going to be the last verse for today. Proverbs 1 and verse 32. Proverbs 1:32. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. That's why I say, you want to destroy your children? Leave them a big inheritance at a young age, and especially don't teach them how to manage money. That'll destroy them quickly. The prosperity of fools will destroy them. So I'm out of time, went longer than I had planned, but didn't cover nearly as much as I thought. So next time we'll pick it up again, and I'm going to talk about winning the lottery. And I got some interesting things to talk about there too. So thank you for your kind and patient attention.